is, but this is a song written by Tommy Sands, a songwriter from Ross Durbin, the county down in the north of Ireland. And years ago, you might have heard us sing and play, myself and Robbie O'Connell and Jimmy Keane, a song that he wrote called There Were Roses. But he's written a lot of other songs which are commentaries on the contemporary situation in the north of Ireland. A couple of years ago, he was asked to visit the UVF headquarters in Belfast, the Ulster Volunteer Force, and they're associated with terroristic activities, if that's the right word, on the majority side there. And he was a little apprehensive about why they were calling this meeting. As it turned out, he didn't have any reason to be, because they just wanted to talk to him. He runs a radio show and says a lot of sensible things, and his songs are very humane statements on a very complex issue. And he couldn't help but notice there that the housing in that part of Belfast was just as bad as in the other minority side, and that the joblessness was the same, and that the same desperate kind of look on the faces of the kids was there. And he knew then in a more direct way, even though he always knew it, and most Irish people do know it, that that eventually, you know, we're going to have to involve all parties in our own future in the north of Ireland without any interference whatever by the English. They have no right to be in our country in any case, never did, and they certainly have no right to be still there. And that sooner or later the IRA and the UVF would have to be part of that process of forging a new society, and they'd have to sit down at the same table. And eventually they will. The only question is when. And he went back home and he wrote this song. Maybe just sing along with the chorus in it. Oh, IRA and UVF, this song is just for you. As you sit down at the table now to see what you can do. At last you've come together after all these tears and time. Sad you didn't do it back in 1989. You know our dreams were all the same, but you would dare proclaim in the anger and the pain. Our dreams were all the same. History calls you savages, but I know that isn't true. For we grew up together, and I am part of you. We all had hopes and fears and dreams and someone else to blame. Too bad we didn't realize our dreams were all the same. You know our dreams were all the same, but who would dare proclaim in the anger and the pain? Our dreams were all the same. We felt the taste of hunger when the factory went away. And then they closed the hospital, they said it would not pay. And as the rich got richer and they pledged to us the skies, all we got were promises and coloured flags to fly. You know our dreams were all the same, but who would dare proclaim in the anger and the pain? Our dreams were all the same. I remember well your little girl, she had ribbons in her hair, when she came to play that Sunday with the children in the square. To think they might be here again, still laughing and alive, if strong men had been wise men in 1989. You know our dreams were all the same, but who would dare proclaim in the anger and the pain? Our dreams were all the same. It was always all or nothing, there was nothing in between. Compromise was treachery, or so it always seemed. And now we're left with nothing but a future we must find, and count the cost of the chances lost in 1989. You know our dreams were all the same, but who would dare proclaim in the anger and the pain? Our dreams were all the same. Oh, IRA and UVF, this song is just for you, as you sit down at the table now to see what you can do. At last you've come together after all these tears and time. Oh, sad you didn't do it back in 1989. You know our dreams were all the same, but who would dare proclaim in the anger and the pain? Our dreams were all the same.
Jack Hall.
Paul is here, it seems the order is determined by who's here, you know. Very systematic and scientific. Jack Vaughan comes from Woodford, County Galway, as most of you know by this point, and Jack's learned a fair share of tunes over the years. A lot of them newly composed.
I guess composing tunes is a gift. Some people have. Some people don't have. Some people try it and they're not too successful at it. And a lot of tunes are composed and you don't find out that they're good until they're about 100 years old. And then somebody comes up with it out of no place and they say, where did that come from? It was there all the time, but nobody bothered with it. And it's funny about them. The people who compose them are kind of scared to compose them, like what Mick said to you about Reevey. He'll call up his friends and see how they like it. Well, that's a very good idea. I think it's a great thing to find out how they like it and then have your own opinion after. Because that reminds me of a man in New York, Martin Wynn, who was a very good composer himself. At a session in there, Martin would usually sit down next to me. And you hear there are a lot of new tunes there from time to time. And I'll say to Martin, that's a new one on me. I never heard of it. And he'll listen. He's a good bit older than I am, and he's met more players. Well, he'll say, I have never heard it before. And I don't ever want to hear it again. Well, nobody wants that said about something they compose. Oh, boy. So, that's what you got through. But anyway, a screw loose, I guess, Mike.
Yep.
But, I'll play you a jig composed by Paddy O'Brien, who's a very good friend of mine. And he composed an awful lot of jigs, reels, and hornpipes. And well, the mate is with me and a new tune. I'll only learn a new tune. There are so many of them now. If it comes into my head and it won't go away, then I have to settle down and learn it. I say it's worth learning. But the one that don't come into my head after listening to it for a while, I figured that one's not worth learning. Because if I did learn that, I would forget it anyway. I'd learn it if somebody else was going to play it and I had to play it with them for any reason. But the minute that, whatever the reason would be, was over, I would forget it immediately. But this one I didn't forget. He called it The Coming of Spring. It's just a jig, a very plain, simple jig. I'm I don't learn too many what you call newly composed songs as such, but the songs are still being composed. The songs in our tradition are being composed all the time. There are a lot of songs being written in the north of Ireland about what's going on at the moment. Well, I sing a song. There's a singer and writer that I like very much, a man called Dick Gahan, and he's written a lot of songs that are worth listening to. I'll sing a different one. Because a man who... No, I must sing that song.
I told you this is very scientific.
will I sing the Ballad of Accounting, or will we leave Keeping tonight?
Whichever you want. I don't know.
No, I'll sing Dick Gahan's one. The other one I was going to mention was Ewan McCall, who was one of the great songwriters of this century, I think. And he took all the social causes, espoused them, and wrote great songs about them. He died about 6 months, 6 or 9 months ago. But he's left behind a huge legacy of songs, and anybody who's interested in writing songs should listen to the works of Ewan McCall. And the way he puts his songs together and so forth. Hey, this is Dick Gahan's. It's just a working song. Hey, we hadn't accompanied him for this, did we?
I don't know.
Come on, you walk at the deedle dum dum, deedle dum dum, deedle dum dum.
Oh yeah.
Or did we? See how close that is now. Ta-da.
We were in Washington for a while, 10 days at the Festival of American Folklife, and people were wondering why, you know, some songs are accompanied and some are unaccompanied, and we were telling them that, you know, there's the art of ballad singing a cappella, and then there's singers who choose to use accompaniment, you know, to accompany certain songs. And in Frank's case, it falls into neither category, because nobody has yet to be found, has yet been found who can accompany him changing the keys all the time. And it requires a whole different approach to the music, you know.
I'm teaching a class the same way. They all change keys. What's the key? Come on, you rocker. Even when I get it, I can't pick it up. This is just a song of work from Dick Gahan. Come on. Give us the thing again. Come on, you rocker. Come on. Give it up a bit, eh?
Okay.
It's crazy. I haven't a notion.
Yeah.
That's more like it. Come, all you workers who toil night and day by hand and by brain to earn your pay, who for centuries long past for no more than your bread have bled for your country and counted your dead. In the factories and mills, in the workshops and mines, we have always been told to keep up with the times, but their skills are not needed. They streamline the job, and with slide rule and stopwatch, our lives they have robbed. Aye, but when the sky darkens, and the prospect is war, who's given a gun, and then pushed to the fore, and expected to die for the land of our birth, though we never own but one handful of earth. We're the first ones to starve. We're the first ones to die. We're the first ones in line for the pie in the sky. But we're always the last when the cream is shared out for the worker he's working when the fat cat's about. Aye, and all of these things the worker has done, from tilling the field to carrying the gun, we've been yoked to the plough since time first began. I and always expected to carry the can, but no more we'll be fooled by the fat cats on high. No longer we'll send out our sons for to die, and no longer we'll beg for the bosses to care, but we'll stand up like men and demand our fair share. Such a short time. That's my fault, because I can't, with that sort of song, I can't do it any other way. Unless you're going to start off with that song on an actual guitar thing. And
Now, Mick, all you musicologists take care from note of this.
Mick.
Very complicated stuff.
You have to be a physic to interpret physic. Psychic, is that it? Psychic. Psychic. So,
This might get worse.
To interpret what I'm going to do next, and Mick just hasn't got physic powers. the clapping. Go up there.
Okay, okay.
As I said, there's a lot of songs been written in the North at the moment. A lot of them are in songs because they're known particularly in the localities that they're written for, and they don't travel. There are a lot of songs like that in Ireland. There's a crowd in Coolay in West Cork who write songs, scurrilous songs, about each other. To the outsider, they don't know all the inferences and all the nuances of what's going on. But to the boys inside, they know every word that's in the song. But this song was written by a friend of mine in Belfast called Brian Moore. I think I sang it last year. But it's a sort of song that verses can go on. And what's been happening in Europe, the miraculous things that have been happening in Europe last year, have contributed verses. And Mick has written a verse or two for I Haven't Got It. So the song, it's, wherever you hear it, is going to be sung differently by different people. It's a song dealing with just the rights of freedom. And there's a derogatory term used by loyalists in the north of Ireland for nationalists called croppies. Anybody who resisted the English crown after 1798 or after the French Revolution was termed derogatively as a croppie. And the term comes from the cropped haircut that the French revolutionaries had. And after 1798, which was our rebellion after the French Revolution, all of those rebels were termed as croppies. On the 12th of July, a few days ago, they would have been marching, and they sing a song called Croppies Lie Down, which is really a triumphalist song on a triumphalist march on the 12th of July. And it's saying, look, we're the ones in power, you lot stay down, you know, back of the bus. So it's that's what the term croppies mean, croppies lie down. So Brian just took their song and twisted it the other way. And although he doesn't mention the north of Ireland, the song is about it. There are two references in it that you must know. And again, this is why some of these songs just don't travel. There's a reference to the Guildford Four. The Guildford Four were four Irishmen, three Irishmen and a girl were arrested and charged with bombing in England. And I don't know that one. See, they were arrested, they were put into prison for a crime they didn't commit. And they were in prison for 15 years. And then the British government found a way of saving face and letting them out. At the same time, the Lord Chief Justice has said, it is better that innocent Irish people should remain in jail, in English jails, rather than that the British system of justice should be impugned. And that's straight from the top. So they were released after 15 years, but how do you give someone back 15 years of their life? There's another family at the moment, the Maguire family, who are in the process of being found innocent, and they were sent to jail. One of them died in jail, and they were supposed to have run a bomb factory, which they never did. And the judge has been, the judge of the case has been criticised by the now Lord Chief Justice for his refusal to put forward essential information, which he had, but which he withheld at the trial. And there is still a group of six, known as the Birmingham Six, who everybody knows is innocent. Everybody knows they're innocent. But the British government can't find a way to let them out without saving face. And they're trying to find a way out. And if in time, you'll find that the British Birmingham Six have been let out. But at the moment, everyone knows, but they can't let them in. Anyway, those are the references in the song. I know a man, and his brains also ran. His mind is befuddled by the love of a crown. He's a drunken pub bore, he will rant and he'll roar at those croppies who will not lie down. those crappies who will not lie down. Ah, when all's said and done, you know freedom is won by the crappies who will not lie down. Now on England's fair shore there are people galore whose greatest delight is Diana's new gown. They have minds filled with thrash, they accept Maggie's lash and curse crappies who will not lie down. Those crappies who will not lie down. Ah, when all's said and done, you know freedom is won by the crappies who will not lie down. I'll sing you the praises of bold Ho Chi Minh and the people of Vietnam gathered all round. How on that bright dawn they marched into Saigon like crappies who would not lie down. Those crappies who would not lie down. Ah, when all's said and done, you know freedom is won by the crappies who will not lie down. On the streets of Soweto the cry it is heard, and the poor white man's forehead is creased with a frown. For it's not what he planned, and he can't understand why those crappies, they will not lie down. Those crappies who will not lie down. Ah, when all's said and done, you know freedom is won by the crappies who will not lie down. And the students who sat in Tiananmen Square and gazed at the troops with the tanks standing there, and sat while the bullets did echo all round like crappies who will not lie down. Those crappies who will not lie down. Ah, when all's said and done, you know freedom is won by the crappies who will not lie down. And the brave Guildford Four in their cold prison cell watched 15 long years going round and around, while no judge would listen to the truth they did tell like crappies who would not lie down. Those crappies who will not lie down. Ah, when all's said and done, you know freedom is won by the crappies who will not lie down. And the Birmingham Six long ago should be free, but how appalling the vista the world would then see. And so British justice continues to frown on those crappies who will not lie down. Those crappies who will not lie down. Ah, when all's said and done, you know freedom is won by the crappies who will not lie down. So here's to the women and here's to the men in every land, every village and town, who know what is right and are ready to fight like crappies who will not lie down. Those crappies who will not lie down. Ah, when all's said and done, you know freedom is won by the crappies who will not lie down. Ah, when all's said and done, you know freedom is won by the crappies who will not lie down.
There you go. You should sing, that verse you have about Central Europe.
I have a picture. I'll play a tune that I wrote a little while ago, and it's called A Week in January.
Album. Oh, it's not an album, it's a CD and a record. I think albums are going to be a thing of the past now, unfortunately. That's a new addition to Elkins, to a tenor guitar, I do believe.
Yep.
Yeah? Great. Okay, Eddie Lenihan's here. He's going to tell you a story.
What was that? On a television programme. 4 years ago. The Late Late Show, in fact. Could I give them a story about that? And I didn't know any story about bats. But I had an idea from somebody who said something in the staff room at home, at school where I teach. Somebody had dropped a comment about listening to something like a bat would. Now, you know yourself, bats are supposed to be deaf and all the rest of it. And it was an idea I worked on, and basing it on the Sean McCool stories and the Fiona and all the rest of it, something like this came out of it. Bats, could I ask you, why aren't they seen in daylight normally now?
Because they
hide. Why?
Anybody to find them.
Any better reason than that? Who knows about the mind of a bat?
Do you?
Is that
a bat?
Of course I do. I'm just going to go and tell them the story. Most people nowadays would say to you, they'll give you a nice scientific explanation of why bats do not come out in the daylight. They say they're blind or they're shy creatures or something like that. All that's a load of nonsense. There's a better and a more logical reason for it. Because when Fionn McCool and the Fiona were defending Ireland against all comers from the sea and from the air and from the clouds, you see, bats were friendly kind of creatures. You could meet them on any road, day or night. And they used to nest in the trees. You could pick them off and bring them home with you, and they'd almost talk to you. But the thing about it was, no one took any notice of them. No. Also in Ireland that time, the big chieftains, the fellows that owned the big forts, you know, they'd have lots of people inside in the feasting halls, in the winter time especially. And it was all very fine, like, to have the carpet on the floor, the rushes and whatnot. You know, they'd keep the floor and all fellas would be spitting in it and that, and you'd be slipping otherwise. But the problem was, what about the ceiling? Geez, the drafts issues come into those holes, like, you'd freeze. And no one knew nothing about this, and no one could do anything about it, because, like, solutions don't always suggest themselves, until you'll see it somewhere else. Fionn McCool was hunting down the country, in Cork. And God damn it, you cannot take it from the Corkmen. They are advanced. He was in having a feast somewhere. And didn't he see this thing? Yes, he could not believe his eyes. He was leaning back in his chair, I suppose, to belch or do something worse. When he looked up, and he saw hanging off of the rafters bats and bats and more bats. And he said to the man in charge, yes, he said, hey, is that deliberate or is it policy or what? And the man in court, God bless you, he said, if you can have a carpet on the floor, why can't you have a carpet in the roof? Well, my God, you know, we never thought of it back at home. John McCool, when he went back the next day, so the first thing he told to the High King, the boys below in Cork, they have a new thing entirely. He explained it, and the King naturally said, well, God knows, eh? The Corkmen can't have it, but the High King must have it too. And he ordered John McCool and the rest of the boys, I want bats, and I want them now. Yes, sir. Off they went with their hunting sacks on their backs, and be God, they collected bats and bats and more bats. They brought back 5 or 6 big sack loads of them. And where'll I put them, Your Majesty? You know what to do with them, Fionn? Right. Hup, hup, lad. You know where bats will be. Up straight away and onto the rafters. And there they'd be then hanging down on the big ears. Listening, but that comes later. It went on. And the Royal Bats of Tara, as they came to be known, were the 8th wonder of the world. And what made it worse entirely was, at all the feasts, they caused the greatest amusement and entertainment, because the people, while they'd be waiting for the next course to be served, you know, they'd be, here, have a bite, have a bite. And they fed the bats so much that the bats got big, fat and sleek. And that was fine, because it filled up the space nicely and kept the people warm in the winter. The only problem was on the stormy nights, you could hear the house, you know, and the wind would be blowing it. And the rafters going this way and that way. Man, if they fell down, you, they'd destroy you. But they didn't, no. Different thing entirely. In those days, the men of Greece used to come to Ireland every year. And not on their holidays either, I might add. The king of Greece's son at the time, his name was Ilan Ilcrahuk, a wild young man, meant to make his reputation, and he'd lead the army of the king of Greece, easy pickings in Ireland, but he was wrong, because those men from Greece, fierce as they were, they would only put their leg on the shore of Ireland when the men of the Fiona would be down on top of them and the fight would start. Oh, the hacking and the tearing, beards ripped off, legs, limbs and all the rest of it. And to make the story very, very short and half civilized, I'll tell you this, he was coming back with his army for 8 solid years and he never managed to get as far as Tara. And the poor man, all he wanted was to see the bats. If he asked, he'd probably get a visa, but he never did. Anyway, it went on and on and on. And the men of the Fiona used love to see the Greeks coming for a finish, they said. More exercise, lads. And they got to like Ilan Ilcrahuk so much that, you know, when the army would be put to flight, they'd say, stop a minute, we want to talk to you. And they would batter him unmercifully with their clubs. They did him no harm, but they would send him back to Greece with his helmet half down to his jaw, and the blacksmiths of the father's court would have to get to work then
upon his head to straighten him out for the next campaign, and on the 8th year he came back, tattered as usual and bedraggled and battered, sailed his fleet into Piraeus, the port of Athens, and who was waiting for him as usual? Only the king. And when he saw the state of them, worse than usual even, he says, "My poor boy, what did them savages of Ireland do to you, the animals, the barbarians, eh?" And the son, he explained like before, "They won't let me ashore, and all I want is to see the bats." "Ah, you poor boy, you poor boy." And the king tried to console him and said, "Don't go there no more, stay away from them. Go down there to Africa, there's friendly people there, they'll welcome you, and they're only waiting for civilization to come to them." But the son, he was like his mother, stubborn to the last degree, and he says, "I'll go back once more." "Very good, you then," says the father. "Take it on yourself, I am sick of you." Back off he went up to the Acropolis to say his prayers. But the son, there was only one thing to be done. When the blacksmiths had him straightened out, and the arrow pried off of him, he went to the chief druid in Athens. Well, they didn't call him druids, they called him philosophers, but he was a classical druid. And he says to him, "Look, any cure at all, any spell that'll put these Irishmen to sleep or something?" "No," he says, "they don't sleep at all," says the druid. "There's only one thing will cure them. Did you ever think of a thing called strategy?" "What's that?" "That's the reason he wasn't getting the better of the men of Ireland. He hadn't too much between his ears at all, the same boy." "But the druid couldn't say that to the king's son?" "But anyway," he says, "look, I know what we'll do, and this is what we'll do. Before you go to Ireland next year, I have something ready for you. Only come back to me when you're ready to sail, and I'll have a secret weapon."
"A what? What's that?"
"I'll have it. Don't worry your little head about it. Go away and enjoy yourself," which he did. Following May came, the ships all assembled to sail as usual, and the druid was as good as his word, because all that winter, what do you think he did with his other druids there? First of all, they sent out messengers to the four corners of Greece, out to the islands, and out to the eastern... What you call it? Thessaly or what? That's sent out anywhere, and they got the best and the fattest and the sleekest and the most intelligent of bats. Brought them to Athens and started teaching them Irish. And the language schools of Athens were so good that time that they could do it, and they did it. By the time Ilan O'Cruach showed up in May, there was his secret weapon, the bats, the Irish-speaking bats, inside in a box in the back room. And the druid said, "Come in here, let me show you." And he did, and he looked at the box. "Yes," he said, "what's in that?" "He opened a small hole at the corner, put your ear to that." And he did. And he could hear the noise inside. And he couldn't understand one word of it. There was throw me on us there. If a man from Connemara heard them bats in the darkness, he wouldn't know that his own father and mother were talking to him. They had done such a good job. Ilan O'Cruach says, "How'll I use them?" "There's only one way, and it's very simple," says the druid. "When you get to the Isle of Man..." That's the place they used to stage all their attacks on Ireland, because I'll tell you more about him in a minute. That's the king of the Isle of Man, the fellow who founded the tourist industry there himself, especially for that. He says, "When you get to the Isle of Man, all you have to do is let out the bats, and they are programmed." That word wasn't there that time, of course, but they'll go straight to Ireland, straight to Tara, and in with the king's bats, and they'll find out all the plans of your Macoun. And the feeling that you have nothing more to do, they'll come back with the information, everything will be fine. The rest is up to you and your men. And he sailed off, out the Mediterranean, through the Pillars of Hercules, up and up and up, and they were very, very poor at navigation that time. Up around Scotland they went, like the Armada did later on, and by God they paid for it. But down they sailed, there by Rathlin Island, and right down to the Isle of Man. And who was waiting there on the cliff? Only the king. Ha ha, coming again. And he could hear the money jingling inside in the money bags. Delighted to see them. He was waiting on the quay when they arrived in. And, "Lads," he says, "delighted to welcome you back." And when they took out of the hold of the ship, the big black box, and they're taking it very carefully, and he says, "What's inside that? Is it a bomb by any chance?" "No," to Charles's Inn and Ilkirk. "The bombs weren't invented at all yet." "When they are, it will be a Greek little inventum. Don't you worry." "No," he says, "watch this." And he opened up the box. Out! And away with the bats, like an arrow across the Irish Sea, came to Tara, flew three times around the hill, in the door, and opened the rafters, and there was the fun. Because how could you tell Irish-speaking bats from Greece and Irish-speaking bats from Ireland? They were all talking the one language. No one knew they were there, until a short time afterwards, the word was brought, "The Greeks, they're in the Isle of Man. Make ready," and make ready is what they did. All the men were called in, King Cormacan wrote his maps, right from take 50 men go there, Dearmond, you go, and every man got his place. Well, all was ready, but above on the rafters, listening to every word, with big ears in them, listening, were the bats. And when all the maps had been rolled up and everyone was gone, down they came, one by one, plop, out the door, and straight back to the Isle of Man, reported everything to Ilan Ilkrip, through an interpreter, of course, he had no Irish, and that was done. Right, he says, we'll do it correctly this year. And they came down on the coast of Ireland, caused havoc because they arrived at all the places they weren't expected. Well, it was the fiercest battle ever fought in Ireland up to that. And the men of the Fianna, they'd be defeated that day, only they knew all the filthy, dusty tricks that would be known in battles, you know, and all that. But they managed to beat them off. But there was lamentation in the land of Ireland that night, because at least 50 or 60 of the captains of the Fianna were killed. You wouldn't mind them, you wouldn't mind ordinary soldiers, they were expendable, but the king's youngest son also got killed. Talk of lamentation, the banshees were out that night. 'Twas woeful, no one got a wink of sleep. And the king, there kneeling down now, King Cormac beside his son's bed, and the lad dead, dead, dead. And he says, we were betrayed, somebody betrayed us, he says. And he got himself into a temper like that, you know, as we people will, kind of a hysteria, I suppose. And he says to Fionn MacCool, send for the druid, get Tascon MacLean, I want to talk to him, he'll know, oh my God, he'll be shot. Well, the druid came up, and he says, what do you want, Your Majesty? Find out who betrayed us, because somebody did betray us. And I will. Off went the druid, consulted his books, and he came back. I don't know, he says, I've got it. And the king made for his spear, I'll find out though. Down he went again, and he used a small bit of the powder that his grandfather had given him. Valuable, precious stuff, he hadn't much of it, and he hadn't the recipe for making more of it. Into the fire he put it, and it was like color television. He saw the pictures in the smoke. And what was the picture he saw first? Only bats flying out of the hall of Tara and going across the sea. And he drew the wrong conclusion entirely, came back to the king and said, Your Majesty, I don't like to tell you this, but we were betrayed by someone very near and dear to you. Was it Fionn MacCool? Was it? I'll execute him, I'll kill him, No, it wasn't. It was the wise above. And the king looked. My bats? Get him at once! I want them out of the house! Yes, yes, Your Majesty. And they had to do everything in reverse. Get the hunting bags again, fill them up, and cut all the bats out. And what was to be done with them? They took him up to the highest point on the hill of Tara. And Tascon MacLear, the druid, he got his book of spells. And when all was ready, he stood above. And he said, Malachthum Ernishkihan Lahir. O Hoig, O Yas, Sir Agashir. And he banished them there and then. The bats. To all the dark places in the world, caves and souterrains and dungeons, and some of them he banished to Transylvania. And you know what happened to those? Picked up very, very messy drinking habits. And make it very short, because there's other people waiting, I just tell you that. That's the reason why, from that age on, there was never a bat seen in the daylight again in Ireland or anywhere else, out of pure shame and disgrace for all the dirty deeds done by their ancestors 2,000 years ago.
It's there practically every year in the ice house at some stage before the week's out. And it's a tune composed by Bob McQuillan. Bob's a dear friend of ours, has been coming down here ever since Irish Week started. And it's called the Augusta Waltz. I know Billy's there. Is Billy around, Billy? Yeah, okay. I think Bob's going to sit in on the piano. And I don't, Joni, can you get a crowd together just to finish it off after this? Is Joni there? If you get a, whoever's with you to finish off after Bill, I guess.
afternoon. I think it's real nice of Nick to have us down here to play this tune for you. I hope you enjoy it. I think it's real nice of Mr. McComiskey to say he'd play it too.
Okay.
I wrote it when I was younger.
Much
younger. And the second one, Brendan and I wrote, when we moved from New York down to Washington and Mulvihill, we moved out of New York. We got a great gig in a bar in Washington. We stayed there, folks living in the Maryland area. We named it after the hotel, but it was a Dubliner pub in Washington. So we named the tune after the hotel. It was the old Commodore Hotel.
Controversial?
bus.